It's time for us to begin tonight. We have begun the last several classes with Daniel chapter 2. I'm going to ask you, if you would please, at this time, to turn again to Daniel chapter 2. It becomes a very important study, a very important passage in our study of the time drawing near for these Old Testament prophecies to be fulfilled. In our study tonight, as we have begun the last several studies with Daniel chapter 2, we note that Daniel is a young captive in the Babylonian period as he serves in the house or the palace of King Nebuchadnezzar. About when did Daniel prophesy? I know we've gone over that a number of times. About 600 years before Christ. And when Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, he asked that someone tell him the dream and explain the interpretation of it. Of course, Daniel does. And we're going to talk about the fulfillment of that, time permitting, tonight. But we know that Daniel answered the question by pointing out there would be four empires, world empires, as it were, to the known world, and that during the days of these kings, identifying the fourth kingdom, the days of the Roman kings, God would set up his kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people. But it will break in pieces and consume all these and stand forever. Now, we were talking about in our last study about how that kingdom was the church, and how that the church is composed, as it were, of citizens of all kinds of nations all over the world. And this is what Daniel was prophesying. This is what Joel was prophesying. When he said in Joel chapter 2, as Peter quotes, interestingly enough, in Acts chapter 2, verse 21, that whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. Now, all of these passages are coming to pass, and this is where we are in our study. But we're interrupted in our study of history and geography by questions that we need to ask. And so if you have your questions on lesson number 40, get those out. I ask you Sunday to be sure you have those completed. I have three more left if you don't have a set of the questions on lesson number 40. Let me know and I'll see to it that you get them. Anyone? Okay, Sarah? Anyone else? Didn't bring with you. Okay, there we go. And the questions are going to be on the board as well, so we can all follow along together. And we talked about some of these in our last study as we came to the conclusion. Who interpreted the dream by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon some 600 years before Christ? We've already answered that. In the dream that was interpreted, what empires do each of the following represent? Now, it started with what portion of the image? Head of gold. What did that represent? Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of it. Another kingdom, the chest and arms of silver, represented the Persian kingdom. And then there was another kingdom, the belly and thighs of brass, represented that of Alexander the Great. We sometimes refer to that as the Grecian Empire or the Alexandrian Empire. And then the days of the fourth kingdom, who was that? The Roman kings. All right, that's right. That's represented by the legs and feet, or the legs of iron and the feet, part of iron and part of clay. Pardon me? Assyria doesn't line up on this image. Assyria, it's good you would ask that. Assyria was a kingdom up here before Nebuchadnezzar. And so at the time that Nebuchadnezzar sees this vision, and Daniel explains it to him, he starts with Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? I wanted to make that clear because that's been a question that's come up before we've studied this. Alright? And then, in the days of what empire did God set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed? The days of the Roman kings. That's right. The fulfillment of the dream. Or in the fulfillment of the dream, named the conquering empires. Well, we've already done that. The Babylonians would conquer the Assyrians, Donna, as we just mentioned. And then the Persians would conquer the Babylonians. And then the Greeks, led by Alexander, would conquer the Persians. And then the Romans would conquer the the Greeks. And so the Romans then would expand their kingdom all the way around the Mediterranean Sea, at least 50 miles deep into the inland. And that way they controlled the commerce of the Mediterranean Sea. Number five, who was given charge of conquering Syria and the eastern shores of the Mediterranean? Now, we didn't talk about that in our question series, but you know the answer to that. Who was given the charge of that? Carolyn? Pompey, that's right. Who went west? Pompey went east. Who went west?
Julius
Caesar, that's right. What area encountered a series of civil conflicts with rivals fighting for the throne? That's easy. Who's always been fighting? The area where the fighting's always taking place. Still today taking place. Okay, the land of Palestine. All right. Why was that so coveted? All right, it was a choke point. That's a good word. It was a choke point. And whoever controlled that controlled the commerce, essentially, the trade routes and so forth and so on. Now, during the period that we're talking about in this area of civil conflicts with rivals were fighting for the throne, what period was that? Now, we're talking about the time when Pompey was coming, and we're talking about the time when Julius Caesar went to the west. When Pompey came, what relationship had Rome had with Palestine? What relationship during this time frame had Rome had with Palestine before Pompey stomped them? All right, little to none, but nonetheless somewhat encouraging them in their battle against who? Syria. You remember you've got Syria up here to the north and somewhat to the east, and how that the Syrian kings, I think Richard, you used another word, Seleucid kings, tried to impose their ways on Palestine, even to the extent of defiling the temple. We talked about that, how that the swine was offered on the altar and so forth and so on. And what resulted from that? What result existed from within Jerusalem as a result of these efforts? They fought against them. That's right. And who became, or this period of time, what was it known as? Maccabean period. That's right. Maccabean period. Now, after the days of the Maccabees, what happened in Palestine? We said, well, Pompey came down and he stomped them. That's right. But what did he find? All right, that's right. That's what he was permitting them to do. But after he stomped them, what did he find when he got there?
Civil war.
Civil war. That's right. We know that the descendants of the Maccabees, as it were, they were fighting among themselves for political power and land to rule over, which has always, it seems, been the history of Palestine. Now, in 48 B.C., Pompey the 12th ordered the killing of what Roman leader? Ptolemy. I'm sorry, I said Pompey. Pardon me? All right, I did. Yeah, I answered that question. Yeah, he ordered the killing of Pompey. Now, where was Pompey at the time? In Egypt. Ptolemy, I think, is the key to that. Who followed Pompey to Egypt and made Cleopatra ruler there? Julius Caesar. Yes, Julius Caesar did that. Now, who helped Julius Caesar in his battles? Herod's daddy, all right, Antipater. He was not a very nice fellow. And if you stay with us on the study of the Herods, I was talking with Richard about this, I'd really encourage you to study the dynasty of the Herods. It's just fascinating. It's quite confusing at times, but it is a fascinating study. And we have a lesson on that, lesson 42, coming up not too far away, hopefully. And hopefully you can use some time between now and then to prepare yourself for a study of the Herod dynasty. Let me suggest to you a reason why that is so interesting and why it is so confusing. We've talked about Antipas, the father of Herod the Great, being such a wicked fellow. Well, his descendants were equally wicked. But when you're reading from the text, you'll read about Herod. An event occurred during the time that Herod was such and such. Now, which Herod? Well, we know that there were several Herods. And it gets real confusing when the Herod in particular that you're reading about is not called by name in the text. It just said the days of Herod. And so there are some ways to kind of figure out which Herod is being discussed in what text. And that's just really fascinating. It becomes important because we know that when Herod the Great died, he divided his empire among his four sons. And then one kind of drops off the radar because he becomes disinherited. And then we learn that Josephus tells us all about the other three, or a good bit about that. I'm going to hold up on that, Richard. I told him I really want to talk about that. So, anyhow, which city was conquered by Rome? Well, we know that was the city of Jerusalem when Pompey came and conquered it. What was the name of Antipater's son who was made the king of the Jews? Herod the Great. That's right. Not a very nice guy. What area became an independent kingdom? And this question I did not frame, but I would call in question the word independent. What area became an independent kingdom under the oversight of the Romans? All right, Judea. That's right. Now, technically, that's what happened. Rome was willing to let them do their thing as long as they didn't do anything that Rome would be upset about. And we'll see some of that as our study progresses. After Julius Caesar was murdered in 44 B.C., who was involved in a power struggle between Mark Antony and Octavian? Pardon me? Cleopatra. That right there, yes, Richard.
It's interesting to know in the Ptolemaic Empire here that this is actually Cleopatra the Seventh.
Yes.
Very, very common name amongst them.
Yes, I heard you comment on that in the lessons that you presented. It would be interesting to get some kind of a historical perspective on all of them, like the Herods, and see what each of them did. But like I said, all that's just interesting. While I say that, I want to call this to your attention. When we study about the Herods, I got to get back to it. When we study about the Herods, and the question is sometimes raised in what passage or in what Herod was being discussed in what passage. And a thought occurred to me as I was studying through that. Instead of just saying, well, this was Herod that did such and such, why doesn't the Bible tell us which Herod? Wouldn't that make it a whole lot easier? Now, what's the obvious conclusion? Doesn't make any difference.
The Bible's not a history book.
It's not a history book. Though it contains history, it's not a history book. Doesn't make any difference.
Well, it's central to the salvation of man.
That's right. It's just not essential. Now, it's interesting, and it's helpful to make our minds work and, you know, identify who these characters were and what they did, fit them in with secular history. That's fine, well, and good. But as far as our salvation is concerned, it doesn't make a bit of difference which Herod it was. Number 14, who was declared the first Roman emperor and given the title of Augustus Caesar? All right, Octavian, that's right. What very famous Bible character was born under the reign of Augustus Caesar? Yeah. God ended the 400 years of biblical silence when he appeared to Zacharias and informed him that he and Elizabeth would have a son. All right, the angel Gabriel. That's right. The angel Gabriel. Number 17, 6 months later, who was told that she would have a son? All right, Mary. Who ordered a census for the purpose of determining a poll tax? All right, Augustus Caesar, let's remember that was Octavian. All right, why did Joseph and Mary go to Bethlehem to be registered? Well, taxes, yes, but why specifically Bethlehem? That's where their family roots were. That's right, that's where they were from. They were of the lineage of David, and so they had originated, as it were, their ancestry in Bethlehem. We talked some about that. I'm tempted to go back and revisit that again, the things that Micah had to say, and of course then the things that Herod did and the things that Caesar did and so forth. But I think we've probably covered it.
Okay. Well,
go ahead.
You had mentioned last time about the fact that when you indicated that they were both of the lineage of David, of course, Mary was apparently related to Elizabeth.
Exactly right.
Who was a Levite.
Yeah.
And so somewhere in their marriage, there was a combination of the Levites and the Judeans.
That's right. In Luke, is it chapter 2, I believe, maybe the early verse, I know, I think it's chapter 2, where we learn in the King James translation, Mary and Elizabeth are referred to as cousins. If you're reading from the American Standard Translation, they're referred to as kinsmen or kinswomen. Okay? So how tight that was, I don't know. But we do know they were of the lineage of David. When we get a little further down the pike, I've mentioned to you a number of times that I've got a chart I want to show you where the lineage of both Joseph and Mary come together at David and then begin to separate and they come together again with the birth of Jesus. And we'll discuss the whys and wherefores when we get to that. It's an exciting portion of study. Any questions or comments just here? Yes.
Might be silly, but did Jesus and John the Baptist knew that they were related?
Probably. I don't know of any text that tells us that, but we know that Mary went to see her kinsman Elizabeth. So as far as knowing whether or not they were related or not, I don't know. But John knew who Jesus was, and he probably did know that they were cousins. That'd be, again, speculation on my part, as we were talking a while ago, but I think very strong speculation. David?
Might be a question for Richard. But Cleopatra wasn't the first, this the Cleopatra that we know about, according to this, wasn't the first Cleopatra.
That's right. That's what he said a while ago. She was number seven.
Number seven.
Yeah. Yeah, she was number seven. That's interesting, isn't it? Almost stopped there. All right, now in your lesson book, lesson number 41, page 165, I asked you last time to be sure you had these ready for tonight. So we'll do that. The first portion of this lesson is to define words and define who people are. So I want you to look at the first one. Tell me about the Septuagint. What is it? Why is it so important to our study?
Well, I don't understand it, but that's Hebrew translated into Greek.
Yes, it's the Old Testament text, Hebrew translated into Greek. How long before Jesus came was that accomplished? Thereabouts, yes. And why is that important to us? James?
If I'm correct, I believe Christ quoted from that more than any other. So that gives legitimacy to the Septuagint as an accurate translation and canon of the Old Law.
That's true. And I like the use of the word accurate and canon. Because what that tells us is that by that time, 200 years before Jesus came, these Old Testament texts were recognized as authentic and had been compiled as a whole. I think that's very significant. It's also significant that though they were not recognized as a part of the canon, some of these so-called additional books that we can read in the Douay translation, where we've referred to 1st and 2nd Maccabees and so forth and so on, that these were also included in the Septuagint translation. Simply because they were recognized as history. Okay? Does that make sense? Alright. Define the following. God-fearer. Did anybody have a stumble over that? God-fearer.
Someone who believes in God, but not exclusively a Christian religion.
Okay. Very, very good. It's somebody who believes in God, in fact, believes in the God of all the Jews, but he doesn't engage necessarily in all of the ceremonies of the law. And in the American Standard Translation, you don't find the use of the expression God-fearing or God-fearer, but you do in the New American Standard Translation. And I want us to look at just a few passages. How many of you are reading out of the New American Standard? Okay, three over here, four or five. All right, John, would you read for me Acts chapter 10, but first tell me who we are reading about. Reading about Cornelius, yes. And in verse 22, those that Cornelius has sent to bring back Peter, what do they report about Cornelius?
22 says, they said, Cornelius, a centurion, a righteous and God-fearing man, well spoken of by the entire nation of the Jews.
All right. We learned that he was a God-fearing man. What does that tell us about Cornelius? He's referred to here as being righteous. But if you'll back up into the text, in chapter 10, verse 2, we see him described how, John?
The devout man and one who feared God with all his household.
All right, so we've got Cornelius, a Gentile who feared God. He's reported as a righteous man who feared God. Now, there's a whole lot to say about that that might create a bit of controversy, but it raises the question, how could Cornelius be deemed righteous, God-fearing, without being under the law of the Jews? In other words, he didn't recognize all of the ceremonial rites and festivals and so forth of the law. How is he a God-fearing, righteous man? Yeah. How did he know what God wanted him to do? All right, that's what he's praying for. That's right, that's what he's praying for.
Well, the fact is, he didn't have to be under the law of the Jews. He wasn't a Jew.
Absolutely, yes. Now, what does that tell us about God and the Gentiles? Up to this point, at least. Yes. That's true. All right, that's right. And so the promises that had been made, or should I say the promise that had been made, that all nations, whosoever and so forth, would hear the law of God that would begin and to be preached in Jerusalem, would hear the gospel. Now the Gentiles have not heard the gospel up to this point in Cornelius' life. But one of the things that we need to note is that does not mean that the Gentiles had no law, that God had not addressed the Gentiles at all. He had. How could Cornelius be described as a devout, God-fearing, praying man, and God hearing his prayers, etc., etc., if he was not compliant with what God had made known to the Gentiles? Bruce? All right, this is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. When we read about Cornelius, he's instructed to go get Peter. And by Peter's report, as he reports in Acts chapter 11, we learn, what is it, about verse 14, that his report is that Cornelius had sent for me that I might speak words whereby he might be saved. Now, I want to suggest to you, if Cornelius hadn't done that, he'd been lost. He needed to do something. He would no longer be any kind of a God-fearing, righteous man if he didn't do what the angel told him to do. But when Peter came, what did he tell him? Words. Whereby he might be saved. What did he command him to do? Be baptized. Why? For the remission of his sins. That's right. That was the message that was to be universally preached. In Acts chapter 13, we see that expression used again, in Acts chapter 13, where is Paul in Acts 13? Somebody set the stage for me. Who's Antioch of Pisidia? He's in Antioch of Pisidia. Who is he addressing in Antioch of Pisidia? All right, no, not yet, Bruce. He's in the synagogue. That's right. He's in the Jewish synagogue. And how do most of the Jews respond to what he's trying to teach them?
Many followed
All right? All right, now go to verse 45, please. All right. All right, so we've got a multitude that evidently believe what Paul said, but by far greater, many rejected him. Wouldn't listen.
I think we see here, because it says that they were envious about this or filled with jealousy, and they began to contradict what was spoken, is that they still felt that even though Paul was preaching about Jesus to them, they felt it was still just for them.
Yeah, exactly right. Now, verse 46, Carolyn, if you have that open there.
Paul and Barnabas spoke out boldly and said, "It was necessary that the word of God be spoken to you first. Since you repudiated and judge yourselves unworthy of eternal life, behold, we are turning to the Gentiles."
All right, that's important. But we note that these Gentiles, how are they described? Verse 43, you noted that a moment ago. Carolyn, you're reading from the New American Standard?
Yes.
Please.
God-fearing.
God-fearing. All right, here were Gentiles who recognized the God of the Jews, but did not necessarily practice all the ceremonial rites and so forth of the Jews. Now in Acts chapter 17, somebody set the stage. Those of you in the Acts class, what's taking place in Acts 17? Pardon me?
Thessalonica.
All right, Paul in Thessalonica. All right, that's a part of it, yes. Acts 17, Paul has been in Thessalonica, and then from there he goes to Berea. All right, let's look at verse 4 now of Acts 17. And John, while you've got your American Standard open there, please, would you read for me verse 4?
Some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas along with a large number of God-fearing Greeks and a number of them.
All right, I said American Standard, New American Standard. So it uses the expression God-fearing. You'll see it again in verse 17 as it describes the condition of those Athens. Now, when we look at these, we see, obviously, then, how the term is used. God-fearer. Someone that recognizes God, but not necessarily somebody that recognizes all the rites and ceremonies of the law. Now, when we talk about a proselyte, who was a proselyte, James?
Somebody who's converted to something.
All right.
That's just a loose step.
All right, that's what I was looking for. First of all, a loose general definition. When someone is proselyted, attempts have been made to change him from this to this. And he becomes this when he becomes a proselyte. Now, in the context of what we're studying,
Ethiopian eunuch,
yes, he was converted. He had been involved with the Jews, and now he becomes a Christian. He's described as a proselyte. Yes. Right back here. I forgot your name. I'm sorry. Do you have a question or comment? Okay. Bruce?
Well, I was just going to mention, during the time in Acts chapter 2, where all the Jews came together, they were proselytes as well.
Okay. We've got devout Jews and proselytes. Yes, in Acts chapter 2. Now, when these became proselytes, to get away from James' very general, loose definition, now we want to be more specific. Now we're talking about those who were Gentiles who have adopted the Jewish religion. In other words, they've endorsed the one God and they've endorsed the ceremonial practices and rites of the law. They've accepted the law of Moses. Define synagogue. Who has that? Melissa?
It's a place of worship for the Jews that required that 10 men of the Jews had to be within a city for them to serve.
Okay, that's right. And we've got a city where we can read that folks were not worshiping in the synagogue, but down by the river. Who was that? Where was that? And what does that indicate to us?
Lydia.
Lydia in Philippi. And what does that indicate to us about Philippi? They didn't have that many Jews in Philippi. Now, as we use the word synagogue, some have, I think, more speculated than anything else from historical studies that a synagogue, as it were, kind of originated during this period of captivity of the Jews, because they had been separated from the temple. The temple had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. And we do know that there were some who were faithful, a remnant that were a part of the captivity. And it has been supposed that this is how the synagogues originated. But be that as it may, Hellenistic. All right, Grecian. Now, when you're studying about Hellenists or Grecians, who comes to mind almost immediately? Pardon me? The widows, yes. And where do I read about the Hellenistic widows? Acts 6, good deal. Acts chapter 6, yes. And so here is a style of Greek civilization that's associated with the spread of the Greek language and culture. And very well could be that in the case of Acts chapter 6, that we're talking about Jews who have accepted the Greek culture. And interestingly enough, in accepting the Greek culture, many of them were named by Greek names. And I find it fascinating that when the apostles give instruction to the church in Jerusalem, those who are complaining about their widows being neglected in the day of administration, he said, select 7 men, point them over this, and when you read the names of the men, what background are the names? They're Greek names. Now that ought to show some wisdom in how to resolve this thing. We've got a problem among the Greeks that are saying we're being slighted. All right, you appoint some folks to take care of it. So they appointed folks who were Greeks. Now, do they have any leg to stand on when it comes to the matter of murmuring and complaining? Now, you've got your own folks taking care of you, so if they're being slighted, it's done by your own folks. It's not us. You see? All right, Gentile. That's real simple.
Not a Jew.
Yeah, Bruce, it means of the nations. Either you were a Jew or you were a Gentile. There really wasn't at this point any other kind of folks to be. Now, we've talked about the Samaritans and so forth, but that's beyond the scope of this study. Define the following. Maccabee. These were the members of the Hasmonean family, especially when we talk about Judas and what was his role in this period. Who was he? Yes, he became somewhat of a general military leader during this period of time to drive the Syrians or the Seleucids back out of Palestine. Now, the Feast of Dedication fits into this period. What was the Feast of Dedication, John?
So, near the end, they got back up in Jerusalem. It's not really up the last day.
Okay. All right, we've got the, actually the victory has occurred, and now we've got the temple cleansed and all that, and it's a day of great celebration. We've got the Syrians pushed out. And, pardon me? Oh, yes, yes, it became known now today as Hanukkah. Yes, David?
Just backing up a little bit, Judas Maccabees, military leader, where was Assad?
Where was the what?
The famous Masada.
That's more New Testament times than this.
Yeah, he said that's more New Testament times than this. This period of the Maccabees was in the intertestamental periods, as you know. So it would be before the coming of Christ. I think what you're talking about is just a little further down the road. And identifying characters, the Essenes. Who were they?
Yes, they were a radical.
Pardon me, Bruce?
They were very radical.
Yes, they were. They were very radical. Strict discipline. They shared the possessions, continued to wait for the Messiah. It is believed that those who collected the Dead Sea Scrolls and hid them came from the Essenes sect of the Jews. By the way, how many of you have seen the Dead Sea Scrolls? 1, 2, 3, 4. If you have an opportunity to do that, that's just fascinating. To look at text that was copied during second, perhaps, century times, and see what was there. Interestingly enough, well, I won't do that. It was in the 1940s when these were discovered. But be that as it may, the Pharisees, who were they? Pardon me? All right, they were called separatists, yes. Why?
Jewish sect that was super strict and legalistic on the traditions and things, not so much.
Well, that's right.
They should have been.
They kind of made laws where there weren't any. You'll notice on the board in Matthew 15, 8 and 9, Jesus rebuked them because of their tradition. And he said, you transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition. What did he call them? Hypocrites. Now remember in the setting of Matthew chapter 15, these Pharisees were very critical of the disciples of the Lord for what, James? Eating without washing their hands. Now, is it just a bad thing to eat with dirty hands? That's not what they were upset about. All right, well, that's probably a good thing to wash your hands before you eat. But what were they upset about, Jenny?
Because he was putting up traditions that he had set up.
All right, a little more detail.
The traditions of the Pharisees stated that they were unclean if they
unclean. Now, Bruce, getting back to the comment that you made, when we look at the text of Matthew chapter 15, why did Jesus call them hypocrites?
Because they knew not the scriptures.
Well, yes, but some of it they knew. Jesus cited a specific instance. What had God commanded of them? Honor your mother and father. Honor your mother and father. What did that entail? Take care of yourself. All right, what did they do?
They had carbon ties where they were supposed to take care of their parents, but they would say, no, I gave it to the temple or the church or however you want to say,
exactly right.
And I can't take care of you.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Jesus called them hypocrites. You bind this over here, which God didn't command you. But then you neglect this over here, and you claim what you're doing is greater service. And so he called them hypocrites. Matthew chapter 23, make a mental note of that. If you want to know where Jesus just frequently called them hypocrites, over and over and over and over and over, Matthew 23 is the context that you want to look at. Now the setting of Matthew chapter 23 is really fascinating. Jesus came into the city of Jerusalem to observe the Passover in chapter 21. Matthew chapter 22 is where he has the questionings, even by the Sadducees, where we talk about the woman who was married to seven brothers, not all at the same time, but married to the seven brothers and so forth. And then when we come to 23, here's this confrontation with Jews. Yes?
So he pretty much always picks on the Pharisees. Is there just a whole lot more Pharisees, or they were in high positions?
They were more dominant. They were the more dominant sect among the Jews. And you can see kind of why. You know, if you're kind of loose in your thinking to start with, you're going to be kind of loose in your practice. But if you're so tight in your thinking, you made laws where God didn't make them, then it would be easy to call you a Pharisee or a hypocrite, because you're going to have to be consistent in what you demand. You can't neglect what God said. You know he said this, while at the same time you've added something to it over here, and you're going to be bound by what you added, but neglect what he said.
The others do this, the Sadducees?
Not as badly. Now the Sadducees, as I said, were kind of loose in their thinking. They didn't necessarily bind as badly as the Pharisees did. The Pharisees were the strictest of the sect of the Jews. James, does that answer your question at least somewhat? James and then Carol.
Well, Mickey, what this boils down to is the Pharisees really saw themselves as defenders of the law.
Yes.
And that's why they were the way they were and why we see them doing these things. To them, they defend the law and no one else does. So they're calling all the shots in their mind.
In their mind, yes. Now, among the dominant sects of the Jews, you've got the Pharisees at the top, then you've got the next group, generally the Sadducees, and then the Essenes would be probably considered next, and there's several lists up, and you can look that up and find some smaller groups among the Jews, but these were the prominent ones. Identify the characteristics. Let's go one more. The Zealots. Yes, I forgot about the Zealots. That would follow the Essenes. Who were they?
Jews.
Pardon me?
Basically military,
yes. What did they want to do? Yeah, essentially so. They were devoted to the Jewish law and religion, but they didn't want to pay tribute to Caesar. Now, they, as Bruce has said, created a political or a military disposition and group because of that, as you can see. And the Sadducees, who were they? Didn't believe in the resurrection. Yes, they only believed in the Pentateuch, as it's sometimes called, the first five books of the Old Testament. Now, interestingly enough, it's the Sadducees that presented the question to Jesus about the resurrection in Matthew chapter 22. Now, one of the things that most of you who have been in our authority class, we studied Matthew 22 when we talked about the importance of a necessary inference. I don't know of any passage that illustrates it really any better. There are others that are equal, but I don't know of any that illustrate it any better than this one. The Sadducees proposed the circumstance of a man who had seven brothers, or the man and seven brothers. And the law said that the man died and don't have children, then his brother is to take his wife and raise seed to his honor. And, of course, the Sadducees' question was, this happens now all through the seven brothers, and their question was, in the resurrection now, whose wife shall she be? And how did Jesus answer that, what they thought, complex question?
You don't know what you're asking.
That's right. You don't know the Scriptures. Nor do you know the power of God. Now, what a slap to these folks who thought they were authoritative. And then, how did he answer further? That's right. Those in heaven are not married or given in marriage. So in the resurrection, she's not going to be anybody's wife. Now, I've had that question asked a number of times. And if you know folks who are of Mormon background, you might have had this discussion with them. Because they want to be married in heaven. Those who were married in the temple in Salt Lake believe that they will be married in heaven. I was talking with a man some time ago whose wife was a member of the church. And, she had passed away. And he had been a very prominent member in the large church. And I'm not so certain in my mind that he was thinking correctly. They were both aged. But he had talked after her passing with some of his relatives over here in Arizona who were still practicing Mormons. And at his late age in life, he decided that he was going to go back to be a Mormon because he wanted to be with his wife in heaven. Well, there's a lot of things wrong with that. We talked about how that, you know, marriage is for this life. You'll know that in the beginning, marriage was described as a one flesh relationship. Well, your flesh is not going to make it to heaven. I'm sorry, but Paul said so in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. It's not going to be that. But your spirit will. But you see that the marriage relationship will not be a relationship in heaven. It's flesh. It ends here. That's all that there is to that. And this man commented, he said, well, I know what you believe about that. Well, I'm certain that he did. He probably made the same arguments time gone by. But here's where he is now. And so we learned that the resurrection, in the resurrection, marriage doesn't exist. Secondly, when Jesus had answered the particulars of their question, then what does he say to them? All right, he's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Now, sew all that up for me, David.
Excuse me?
Sew all that up for me. What's the conclusion?
Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are still alive.
That's right. That's right.
And he was the God of the living. See, they weren't.
Yeah. Yeah. He said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that ties it together. Yes.
So they accepted only the first five books. So did they think Enoch was a special case? Where is he at?
Oh, you're muddying the water, James. Let's not do that. Yeah.
And if you're going to take that kind of position, but you say those first five books are authoritative, you've got at least one account where a man didn't die, but God took him. So yeah. Where's he at?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, when we study about false religions, whether we're talking about these sects among the Jews or modern-day false religions, often I'm asked, well, what do they say to this, and why do they believe that? And my general comment on that is, don't ask me to explain an erroneous religion. There is no real explanation for it. Now, you can make some of the arguments that they make and show the inconsistency of them, so forth, but why do you believe this? You know, if you want to really find that out, find, for example, why does a person who is a Mormon believe that? Then ask the Mormon. Why do you believe that? Where does the Bible teach that?
If you're not going to believe in an afterlife, when you're dead, you're like Rover, you're dead all over, then it would seem to me the only reason for a sect like the Sadducees to exist would be purely political.
Well, you know, Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, I believe it is, or is it Romans chapter 14, he said, this is all there is. And that's a loose paraphrase. If this is all there is, then let us eat, drink, and be merry. Why not? Comment? Okay.
Well, anyway, I was going to say that they believed and they had a will for God, but it wasn't according to truth.
That's right.
The traditions of men versus the Word of God.
That's exactly right. And that created the problem. Exactly. All right, capital cities. What's the capital of Egypt? All right. What's the capital of Syria? Pardon me? Antioch of Syria, yes. And you see where that is on our map. This little view right here probably doesn't help us, but this one does. You see where Antioch is of Syria up here. Now, it became a jumping-off place for the Apostle Paul and the three preaching tours that he made out of Antioch, sent by the church there. What was the capital of Greece?
Athens.
All right, Athens. What was the capital of, well, don't have that. Name the rulers. The general who conquered from Greece to India. Alexandria. Or Alexander, yes. And the king who called himself Zeus. All right. Antiochus or Antiochus the Fourth. And what did he call, what did he call himself? Yeah, king, but there's a specific word. Epiphanes. Yeah, Antiochus Epiphanes, yes. The Egyptian dynasty, who ruled over that? All right, the Ptolemies. And then the Syrian dynasty, the Seleucids. Okay. And then the Maccabean dynasty. All right, good. And then, name the rulers. The Roman general who conquered Jerusalem. We just talked about that. Pompey. All right. And the first general of the Maccabean revolt. We just talked about that. All right, Judas. And the ruler, Julius Caesar, set up over Egypt. All right, Cleopatra. Yes. The king of Judea when Christ was born. Herod, yes. He was appointed by Caesar, yes. Herod, yes. Somebody said the first?
Yes.
Okay. Herod the Great, yes. The emperor of Rome when Christ was born. Augustus, who was also called Octavian. Very good. Short answers, we'll get to that next time. Be sure that you do some study on lesson 42 and the appropriate passages in our lesson book as we study the dynasty of the Herods.